Hi, this is Allison Sheridan of the No Silicast podcast, hosted at podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever-so-slight Macintosh bias. Today is Sunday, March 29th, 2009, and this is show number 197. Well, we're inching up there. We're getting pretty close to 200. We have a ton to talk about on the show today. In fact, I'm probably going to have to cut some material out and move it to next week because there's just too much. We better dig in. Well, you'd think I'd be done buying gear for recording by now, but new challenges keep arising. About a month ago, Tim Verporten of the Mac Review Cast noticed a bad hum coming through on my recordings after he ran some compression software on my voice. And after much diagnosis, I was able to figure out that my MacBook Pro was actually transmitting a vibration through my desk, up through the boom arm for my microphone, and making noise into the mic. I thought that sounded goofy, but I could lift the laptop and it would go away. I'd set it down and it'd be right back. It was like the spinning of the disk drive was making everything vibrate. I tried a couple of things to prop up the Mac, like I've got one of those iLap things, and that still vibrated plenty, and then I've got a couple other pads and things, and those still vibrated. Finally, I figured out that I could set it on bubble wrap, and that gave me really good sound isolation. But Bart suggested at some point I might have exploding bubbles coming from the heat, so that's probably not the best long-term solution. Well, Steve bought me the perfect solution. It's a shock mount that attaches to the boom arm, and it's basically a series of rubber bands, and you just kind of tangle the microphone into the rubber bands, and it keeps it just kind of bouncing around or not bouncing around as everything else moves. It also comes with a pop filter that's the same size as the one I had before, but the one I had before was on this long, flexible arm, and I was always messing with it, trying to get it in the right place, and then it would leave this big bulge of flexible arm in my way, and I kept bumping into it, and every once a year, he did this, bam, in the middle of the recording. So now I look really, really professional. If you'd been in the live chat room tonight on ustream.tv/nosilicast at 5 p.m., I don't know, Pacific Standard Time, GMT minus 7, GMT minus 8, I'm not even sure anymore. But if you had been there, you'd have been able to see my new flex mount. I know that would have really excited you. All right. One quick update here. Remember your assignment a while back to prove that the reason my buddy Ron's picture of me with the French maids was only popular because I was in the picture? Bart had scoffed at my suggestion that the internationally famous superstar Allison Sheridan was the real draw to that photo. Well, you guys did prove him wrong, and it turns out you're still doing it. Ron just sent me an email this week. The photo has gone from 4,860 visits to 7,500 visits. My continuing thanks for proving Bart wrong on this. Listener Cedric wrote in with an unusual request I'm hoping one of you can help him with. He wrote, "Do you happen to know of a construction site durable iPod dock / boombox? I'm an electrical contractor who has had more than his share of earbuds snagged out of his ears while working. Thank heavens for the $1.47 cheapies at Walmart." Well, I shot out a tweet for Cedric's question, and Connor suggested something from OtterBox, but I think those are more the just iPod cases that might help, but since he's obviously wants to get rid of the earbud situation, maybe that's not quite the way to go. Donald Burr sent over a link to an article on popularmechanics.com for a do-it-yourself project. That actually looks pretty cool, and Cedric sounds like the kind of guy who might just be up for that kind of project. If anyone else has a recommendation for a construction site durable iPod dock / boombox, shoot me an email at allison@podfeet.com so we can help Cedric out.
Dumb.
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 Dumb questions.
Dumb questions.
Dumb questions.
Good one.
What is?
How come I always have to?
It's time for Dumb Question Corner.
Well, Kate from Michigan has sent in some of the best dumb questions. Here's her latest email. "Hi, Allison. With the risk of becoming the queen of dumb questions, here's one that's been bothering me for a very long time. What is the point of Apple TV? It doesn't have a TV tuner, right? So I can't really get TV on it. I can get streaming video on my MacBook and hook it up to my TV, but it looks terrible. I think my TV has a resolution of about 20 by 30, and my MacBook has a lot more. I have a DVD player. My DVD collection equals zero. iTunes? If I listen to music, it's on CDs, and it plays on the big speakers up in the bookshelves. What do people use their Apple TVs for? What am I missing? Well, gotta go. I have a pile of library books calling my name." Well, Kate, you have dubbed yourself the Queen of Dumb Questions, and I think you should wear that title with honor because you really get the point of Dumb Question Corner. I bet there's a lot of people who have the same question, and I'm actually afraid I might be one of them. I think I can walk through some of the explanation, but I'm going to bring in an expert to help us out with the rest. Let's get started here. Your first question is, the Apple TV doesn't have a TV tuner, right? So I can't really get TV on it. Well, I think the whole idea is to change your definition of TV. If you define TV as moving imagery delivered by big networks over a cable, satellite, or over the air, then you're right. But open your idea of what TV actually is. If you watch the Mac Voices TV podcast displayed on your television, is that not TV? Heck, I'll take a good video podcast about Mac stuff any day over watching American Idol or something like that. Who's to say what TV actually is anymore? Next up, I can get streaming video on my MacBook and hook it to my TV, but it looks terrible. This is where the new TV set technology has come a long ways. On a new TV with, say, 1080p resolution or lines per whatever per Fortnite, let's say 16:9 aspect ratio, that would be equivalent to a computer screen of 1080x600 DPI. The new MacBooks are 1280x800, so that would make the new TVs about two-thirds of the total resolution or information of your MacBook, but it's displaying it huge and you sit far away, so it actually does look spectacular. If you do have a newer TV, you might have hooked your MacBook up to your TV with a non-digital connection. I remember the first day we got a plasma and I was thrilled to be able to plug in my MacBook Pro and it would look great and it looked dreadful. My buddy Ron suggested that instead of using a VGA connection, which is analog and actually has to convert the signal, I should try using a digital connection like DVI. I swapped out that cable and voila, it was gorgeous. And by the way, that was on a 1080i TV, not 1080p like the new ones. As far as playing music through the TV, we do have a much better receiver and speakers in our TV room than anywhere else in the house. As you know, I don't listen to any music at all. Turns out it just bores me. It's not like I don't like music. I just think it's boring. But we could sit and listen to music in there, and it would sound great. The TV wouldn't be involved in the plot at all, though. We have an AV receiver hooked up to good speakers, but we don't use the TV speakers. Your bookshelf speakers are probably better than the TV speakers, too. Now, if you have a DVD player, but a collection of zero, that's kind of interesting. I can see it, though. When we had a VCR, we never bought movies, but rented tapes constantly. For some reason, when DVDs came along, we turned into nutcases about buying movies we like. Oddly, we do still rent movies on DVD every week with about 224 DVDs in our collection. I guess I didn't sell you on buying DVDpedia, did I, if you have no DVDs? Well, Blu-ray DVDs on a high-def 120Hz DVD player are blow your socks off. I'm sorry, 120Hz TV are blow your socks off amazing. We watched WALL-E and I Am Legend on Blu-ray the first day we got our new TV, and we all just kept saying, wow, look at that. It was amazing. Oh, wait. This was supposed to be about Apple TV, wasn't it? Well, after all my elaborate explanations, guess what? I don't have an Apple TV either. I don't even have a Mac hooked up to it, except under extreme conditions, like when our cable TV went out at 8:03 p.m. on the first night Lost was on this season. So I had to go BitTorrent the show and play it on my MacBook Pro hooked up to the big TV over a DVI cable. Well, I think I might enjoy an Apple TV for watching video podcasts, but there's a problem there. I happen to be a woman, which means I'm not allowed to choose what we have on our TV. I'm not even allowed to use the remote control. You know, that would be his domain. Ah, heck. Luckily, I don't care too much about what's on TV anyway. I care about what's on my Mac. So I thought it would be really helpful if we actually brought in someone who does use an Apple TV. So we have Katie Floyd of the MacCore podcast on the line here. How are you doing today, Katie?
I'm great, Allison. How are you?
I'm doing great. Well, I was just explaining to Kate from Michigan that I don't use an Apple TV, but I'm also not allowed to use the remote control anyway on the TV because I have a husband and it takes control of the remote. But I wanted to see what you actually use the Apple TV for, because I know you think it's cool beans, right?
Yeah, well, I don't have a husband, so I don't have to worry about that. I am the master of my remote, which
is
wonderful.
What's that like?
It's great. I have an Apple TV, and I absolutely love it. And I have never come across someone who has one who doesn't absolutely love it. So there's got to be something about it. But there are a couple of ways to think of an Apple TV, and I don't know if it's necessarily going to be the right thing for Kate from Michigan, but maybe it will be for some of your other listeners. So the first way to think of an Apple TV as an iPod, that your TV serves as the screen for this iPod, because that's basically what it is. It's got a hard drive, and it syncs with iTunes, and pretty much anything that you've got in iTunes, you can get into your Apple TV.
So if
you live a very Apple-centric world, and you've got all of your stuff in iTunes, then the Apple TV is going to be great for you. The other way that you can think of it is kind of as a mini Mac Mini, for lack of a better term, because it is a little mini computer in the Apple TV, and hackers out there have done all kinds of things with it, and we can get to some of that in a minute. But the big thing is that the Apple TV, straight out of the box from Apple, acts like an iPod, and then it takes all of your stuff from iTunes and gets it to your big screen TV. My favorite thing that I'm using this for is obviously screencasts. I watch a lot of the Buzz Out Loud or the CNET video podcasts, and I'm liking
those.
Don McAllister's screencasts, I've got those on, and I'm loving those. And so many video podcasts now are being done in HD, and they just look great on a big 16:9 screen.
Okay.
So that's probably my favorite. The other thing I like is my Apple TV. I live in a smaller condo, and it's in my living room, which is centrally located right next to my kitchen. And it also can act as an AirTunes kind of base station, I guess. So you can use it to stream audio from your iPhone, from your Mac, from anywhere, really, through the Apple TV to either your TV. Yeah, to either your TV speakers, or preferably you've got some kind of home entertainment, speaker setup going. So I use it when I'm downstairs, cooking or in the kitchen or just, cleaning around to use the speakers that are there in my home entertainment system to listen to podcasts, listen to music, anything like that.
So you're saying that in that case, the content is on your iPhone and you're broadcasting that to the Apple TV? Is that what you said?
Well, I guess I got that wrong, because there's a remote app on the iPhone that will allow you to control your iTunes library. So in my case, I've got a Mac upstairs that's running that's got all my content on it.
Okay.
That's kind of weird. Yeah.
It's a remote control that's going to the upstairs to get to the iTunes library, which is talking to the Apple TV, which is right next to you.
Right. So it's, or I could do it with the Apple TV remote, because your Apple TV will also sync with your Mac. So theoretically, your podcasts and your music are there. But, if you're in the kitchen cooking dinner and you've got your iPhone next to you, which your iPhone is always next to you.
Of course. I have it hooked on my bathrobe.
Yeah. So you pop open the remote app and say, okay, I want to listen to the NoSillaCast. So I go through and I click it and I click on the little speakers and I say, okay, broadcast to my Apple TV. If I'm doing stuff around the house, I've got my Mac set up in my home office. I've got speakers set up in my bedroom through an Airport Express. I've got my Apple TV downstairs. So you can have music going everywhere. So in that case, it just acts like another AirTunes base station. And then, of course, you've got all the Apple stuff. You can rent movies. You can buy movies. I've never bought movies, and I've rented only a handful of them. But
was that experience good or not? Is that why you didn't?
Oh, no. No, it was a great experience. It was just, I use Netflix, and I find that's more economical. And, I get my Netflix, and I get my streaming Netflix on my TiVo. And if there's a movie that I really want to see, or if I have people over, it's really cool to say, hey, let's see what's on the Apple TV. And they always get a big kick out of that, going, you can just, download a movie right now? It's like, yeah, here we go.
Show off.
Yeah. So
is there a hard drive in the Apple TV?
There is. The baseline model's got a 40-gig hard drive.
Wow.
The larger model, it's got a 160-gig hard drive. But your Apple TV will either sync or stream with one of your Macs. So if you've got a Mac that's always on, that hosts, you've got videos or you've got podcasts and you've got more than 40 gigs worth of stuff in your iTunes library, if it's not synced to the Apple TV, it will stream. And in my case, I've got a time capsule, so it streams over N, and it's pretty snappy. I haven't had any problems with things that are streaming from one of my Macs to the Apple TV.
See, now, would I be able to I've got an Airport Extreme which supports, you can put an external hard drive onto that with the USB port that's on that. Would I be able to stream from that? Or would I have to have a Mac awake and controlling it in some way?
I believe, and that's a good question because I would like to do that, but I believe you have to have a Mac awake and controlling it some way.
I'm starting to think I'm going to have to start being a big, fat energy hog.
I know.
We're about to retire Steve's G5, and in another conversation on another subject he was thinking maybe he sets it up as a server, but, I mean, that G5, you can heat a house with that thing. It's just, it's got to be the least energy efficient thing in our house now that I got rid of our 25-year-old refrigerator.
Right.
And it just depresses me to think of having that thing on all the time, but if you don't have a Mac on, then you can't do all these cool things, right?
Well, you should go buy a Mac Mini. That's how Apple's pushing those now that they're all eco-friendly.
Well, that's kind of what I was thinking. So the Apple TV rents $200. The Mac Mini is $600.
Right.
But you could have a lot of storage hooked right up to that. You wouldn't have to deal with streaming, so you'd always have it faster, that sort of thing. Is that the advantage?
That's the advantage. But the big advantage from the Apple TV is it's got all the connectors you need. It's already got HDMI built in, so you can plug it into your TV with one cable, which is what I've done.
Wait, the Apple TV has HDMI or the Mac Mini?
The Apple
HDMI?
TV. The Apple TV does. The Mac Mini does not. Now, you can get some adapters and some converters and get the Mac Mini into HDMI. The Apple TV is just easy. It's just got this remote, and you can do everything from the remote. You're not having to get an external keyboard, an external mouse. But, you know, really, it depends on what you've got in iTunes. Apple, of course, wants you to buy movies and to rent movies from iTunes. If you've got your own DVDs that you legally own and want to rip into iTunes so that you can have your video library on your Apple TV, it's kind of a legal fuzzy gray area as to whether or not you can legally rip your own DVDs. But, you know, basically any content that you can get into iTunes, you can get into the Apple TV.
Now, that's a thought. I know people have been talking to me about ripping DVDs into iTunes and other sources. I am about to back up all of our home movies onto sparse disk images, but I think I need to rip them into some different form in order for that to work. In fact, I'm just basically copying them to sparse disk images as a backup.
Right.
But it seems
you're
like I also have to encode them.
Yeah, into some kind of QuickTime formatter. You know, use Handbrake. You can use Handbrake to convert your unencrypted DVD.
Right. Well, we're probably getting off onto a whole new topic.
Yeah,
there.
That's a whole other topic.
Would you say at the beginning we could talk for 10 minutes or an hour? How long did I want to go?
Yeah. The other thing that the Apple TV can be is it can be like a mini Mac. And I'm sure people have heard about, you know, hacking your Apple TV to put Boxy on it, people trying to put Boxy on it so that there's Hulu functionality. I have done that, and it's kind of back and forth as to whether it works or whether it doesn't because Hulu and Boxy are having a big fight and...
Which is helped out a lot by the content owners, as I understand.
Exactly.
I don't think Hulu would have chosen that path.
No, it sounds like the content owners are cracking down, which to me makes absolutely no sense, because if you're paid via advertising that are in your shows, you want as many eyeballs on those as possible. So
Right.
I don't know. The only thing I can figure is they're working on exclusive content deals elsewhere. It was very easy to hack an Apple TV. I actually did a show on it. Took less than 20 minutes to do. You basically create a little patch stick with this USB drive, plug it into the back of your Apple TV and restart it, and all of a sudden you can install apps like Boxy. And Boxy is just kind of an alternative media browser, which I really don't use any of the functionality of Boxy other than to access Hulu content, which was really my favorite because, you know, for example, I was catching up on 30 Rock. And I was able to get the past seasons. Yeah, I was able to get the past seasons over Netflix, but of course you couldn't get the current season over Netflix. And at that time, I was only, you know, 4 or 5 shows away from getting caught up. I was like, all right, well, do I want to spend, you know, $6 or $8 in iTunes to download these, which I could have, which, you know, wouldn't have been a big expense. Or do I want to take, you know, a day and a half out of my life and, you know, hook up Boxy and hack the Apple
TV? Clearly an obvious choice.
I know, obviously.
$12, day and a half hacking. I can understand your path.
Yeah, and it honestly it didn't take that long. But then, of course, I was like, okay, well, I'm at it. I've got to do a podcast about it. So there was all that editing and things. But I enjoy it, and I, you know, probably my Apple TV more recently I've used more for Hulu content.
Okay.
Than anything else. But the good news is I got caught up on all of my shows just before they pulled it. So I'm not using it as much anymore.
Hmm. Okay. But you still do use the Apple TV, you said?
I do. I love the Apple TV. I use it, if not every day, at least every other day to catch up on, you know, video podcasts or whatnot.
I'm thinking for the music and things for those people in my family who actually listen to music, we've got a really nice home theater system downstairs with the TV, but it only plays TV shows, you know?
Right.
And to be able to stream music to it would be pretty nice. Maybe during parties. Anybody who's listened to my show for any length of time knows I don't listen to any music at all, so that right. wouldn't be a big feature, but I would love to be able to watch some video podcasts on the big TV. Yeah.
Now, granted, you could do the music streaming thing with an Airport Express, which is, you know, $99 versus $199 for the baseline Apple TV. But, you know, if you're going to buy an Airport Express anyway for that spot, you know, you're really only talking another $100 and you've got, you know, all the video functionality as well.
Yeah, you know, I had an Airport Express and I could never get it to work consistently. It basically irritated me. Every time I tried to use it, it was a nightmare. So I sold it to a kid for $50 and we were both happy.
Ah, well, there you go. I had lots of problems with the G version with a lot of interference, but the Apple TV, because it runs on end, doesn't seem to have any problem.
Okay. Well, I think we've got a whole nother perspective on this, and hopefully we've answered Kate's question. It might not be right for Kate, but it sounds like a lot of people really do love him.
Yeah. If you live in the Apple universe and if you've got your content in iTunes, it's great.
Sounds like fun. Well, Katie, how can people find you and catch up with you?
They can find me with you on the Mac Roundtable at macroundtable.com. And I also have my own show with my co-host, Corey. We're at themaccore.com.
And how about Twitter?
Twitter. Twitter.com/maccore.
All right. That sounds like enough places where you're going to sound like Chuck, right?
I know. Can't go anymore.
All right, Katie, thanks for taking time with us today.
Thank you.
Well, last week on the show, Bart and I talked at length with my husband, Steve, about his video capture process for converting home movies from old VHS tapes to DVDs. We got a lot of great emails about how much people enjoyed that conversation. Brent Cameron, a.k.a. Truck Lover on Twitter, contacted Steve directly and suggested the two of them do a Skype chat about his process. It turns out he does exactly the same thing Steve's doing, creating the exact same product, but he gets there an entirely different way with entirely different tools. I think this is really interesting. Steve suggested I call this interview More Than One Way to Skin a DVD. I hope you enjoy it. Let's have a listen.
Well, good morning. This is Steve Sheridan here with Brent Cameron, otherwise known as Truck Lover. Brent is a listener of the NoCilla cast and a frequent visitor of the chat room during the NoCilla cast live recording Sundays at 5 p.m. PST. And I think that's currently GMT minus 7 hours. If I'm not mistaken. How you doing this morning, Brent?
Oh, I'm doing fantastic. I'm glad to be here talking with you about the video digitizing and backup and just all that, because I think it's a very relative source, because a lot of us, our parents had old movies that were analog, and those videos don't last forever. So I'm really excited to hear that you and Allison and Bart, we're talking about this subject because it's relative and people need to be thinking about it. And you need to be preserving this video before it degrades to the point where it's not even watchable. And we want to keep those memories. And so, very excellent topic to be talking about.
Yeah, I think it is. And it's good to let all of Allison's listeners be aware of that so they can capture all of those good memories digitally. Now, as I shared my experiences, I noticed you were asking a few questions, and you had, from what I could tell, a pretty thorough process flow for recording and editing and archiving all of your video. And I wanted to learn a little more about how you do it, because I think I'm still a bit of in the novice category, mm-hmm. and I think I could probably learn a bit from you as well as Allison's listeners. So would you mind going over, first of all, some of the tools you use for recording both video and audio, and just let us know maybe some of the pros and cons of those.
Okay, no problem. I actually use a device called the ITV 250 Plus. What it is a TV tuner for your Mac. You can watch cable television, you know, satellite, doesn't matter. You can hook up your VCR to it, your PlayStation. It'll accept the composite video input. It also has an S video input as well, and it's a DVR. So if you have a Mac, external hard drive or something, you can record all your favorite TV shows, movies, things of that nature.
Got it.
And so it works over USB. It's a powered device. It takes 120 volts. They do offer USB-only models. I like this one because it has built-in hardware compression, and I use it with a 2004 PowerMac G5, so it helps a little bit with the CPU usage. So it's a DVR for your Mac, watch TV and all that. So also you can play your VCR, you know, hook up your PlayStation to your Mac, and that's what I do. So my family had about 130, 140 VHS movies, and this is, you know, some of the Disney movies, you know, like Lion King and things like that. And I wanted to preserve that for, you know, like my kids when I have them. Also, just the family videos. And so what I have is just a standard VCR, and a lot of the tapes were the regular size VHS tapes, but all my family movies were those little, I don't know what they're called, but the mini VHS tapes.
You put those in the adapter?
Yes, correct. Put them in the adapter, and I, you know, fired up ITV, right, and I selected the source, and all I have to do is I can select how the in the preferences, the recording quality. I can go with extended play DVD for 240 minutes, long play, standard DVD, and high DVD at 90 minutes. Like high DVD at 90 minutes will record 2.7 gigabytes per hour. That's a little bit high, and so I kind of experimented with that, and I kind of decided on using the long play DVD setting, and that records at 1.3 gigabytes per hour at 720 by 480 aspect ratio. It's an MPEG-2
file. So, Brent,
file.
That long versus short recording, mm-hmm. is that determined by how much compression is applied to the file that's stored?
Exactly. As it's coming in, you know, I can say, well, do I want this 30-minute movie, or let's just say an hour-long movie, you know, is it going to be a 1.3 gigabyte file, or is it going to be a 2.7 gigabyte file? So I kind of have to determine the quality up front of what the ITV is going to record it at. It's not freely uncompressed video, and then I decide later. So that's one thing to note about the ITV.
So most of the source material you're transposing to digital is are movies that are commercial rather than, say, home movies that you've recorded yourself?
I had a full garbage bag full of movies. I mean, it was a good mix between commercial stuff and a lot of home movies. And I needed an easy way to record it and edit that. And I have Final Cut Pro. I have iMovie 09, but the ITV allows you to edit those unwanted commercials out. It also allows you to edit out the black and white fuzz between video one and video two, and the feet, you know, the camera pointing at the ground, and all the things that are just uninteresting. You can edit all that.
I never do that. I never have a problem. Never have a problem pointing the camera at the ground. Not. So let's move a bit to the editing phase. You mentioned ITV allows you to edit as well as Final Cut Pro and iMovie. So of those, do you use all three of those tools to do your editing, or do you use one or the other depending on what you're trying to achieve?
I use only ITV for my editing, and to note that is spelled EYETV. It does not use an ITV. I use the built-in editor as it is, and I can get, you know, very accurate down to the frame of when I want my cut points at. So it's a good rough editor. Now, and of course, it's not going to give you as much control and finesse as like Final Cut Express. But for what we're using it for what my parents are using it for, they wanted a DVD, just like you and Allison. They're like, well, we want the finished copy to be a DVD with some menus and things like that. I wanted just a straight Apple TV file. And so the parents got the DVD media. And I was like, well, that will degrade over time. What I want is a digital copy. So I edit strictly in the ITV app. All right, get all my edit points just right, and then I can export that as an Apple TV format, an iPhone format, etc. There's a bunch of different presets built into the ITV app to export that file at. I also use Toast to actually make the menus the chapters and things like that. And so that's all built in, came with the ITV application. So pop in a blank DVD, well, use Toast, and done.
Excellent. So ITV allows, does that interface well with Toast in terms of chapter markers being recognized by Toast as it creates the DVD?
The way it works is you're not going to have as much finesse with Toast and ITV that you would if you went the way you ran your workflow with iMovie. This grabs like individual movies, and I did not take the time to get down to the very detail of the, you know, this movie, that movie, and that movie. The way I did chapter markers is, okay, well, I took this one 30-minute VHS tape, and that's a chapter. All right, well, I have the second, you know, mini VHS tape, and that's another chapter. That's kind of how my dad recorded the video back in the 80s and 90s. And so that's how I broke down my chapter markers. And I knew my parents weren't really looking for every single chapter marker of all these home movies. They weren't looking for that. They just wanted it preserved. They wanted to be able to put that DVD in their TV and just play it and quickly find, like, oh, okay, well, you know, Brent's playing baseball. All right. And if that video has something else in it, that's fine. But I wrote on the DVD, after burning it, every video that was on there. So they can just look at the DVD with the felt tip marker on there to see, okay, well, Brent's baseball, or Brent learning how to ride his bike. They can look at the DVD and say, okay, this content is on this DVD. And they had a stack of about 15 DVDs.
Got it. So for the most part, ITV allows the editing control that you needed for your project, for your workflow.
Exactly.
You didn't need to resort to Final Cut Pro or Express or those other tools.
I didn't find the need for it, and that's something that I can always go to after the fact, because I have an H.264 encoded video that if I want to throw in iMovie, I can later.
Okay. So I find it kind of interesting. We're about a generation apart. I'm probably about the age of your parents. And I, like them, am comfortable with removable media that I can carry around with me, DVDs, for instance, and later possibly Blu-ray.
Mm-hmm.
I notice you're more comfortable keeping your files on hard disk. And I guess your rationale is that it should not degrade over time.
Correct.
I take that to mean that, assuming you're backed up well, that won't degrade over time, because you could have a catastrophic failure, but you're backed up well enough that, mm-hmm. that's not a concern to you, right?
No, it's not. I trust hard drives over physical media, CDs, any day. Backup strategy. Okay, so I'm using a PowerMac G5 for that, and it has a couple of internal hard drives. Okay. I record all this content to the PowerMac G5. There's a Time Machine volume backing up the first volume. I also have a Drobo that's hooked up via FireWire 800. I have yes. Yeah,
don't
I know. Well, you know, Allison might not like me, but yes, I do have a Drobo, and I had the RAID array before, and it was hard to expand with that. I had a 3 terabyte RAID array, and I was like, okay, I'm at a point where I expand and I have to replace all the hard drives. And I really searched long and hard for, like, okay, what's the best solution? How can I grow my digital life over time? I said, I need something that will expand with me. And having 5 hard drives in one PowerMac G5 was just getting to be a headache as far as expandability, scalability.
Got it.
So went the Drobo route.
How much storage do you have on your Drobo currently?
Currently 3.25 terabytes, and it's 70% full. And to note that that's 3.25 terabytes total. And the way the Drobo works is that if you have whatever the largest hard drive is, you're not going to actually be able to use that. That's reserved for, you know, in case a hard drive fails. So I have 2.25 terabytes of actual usable space, and it's already 70% full. So I've got my entire iTunes library on there. I have carbon copy cloned disk images of both my MacBook Pro and my PowerMac G5. So I have dedicated Time Machine volumes for the MacBook Pro and the G5, as well as cloned disk images on the Drobo. So in case, you know, like the fire is going down and, you know, the age-old question is like, if you can grab one thing, what would it be? I would grab my Drobo.
But how big is this device? How easy is it to grab it and take it out the door with you?
It weighs a few pounds. It's about 10 inches in length. And about 7 inches wide. I mean, it weighs a few pounds. I mean, you have to remember it has four SATA hard drives in it. So it weighs a few pounds. I mean, it's not the lightest weight, maybe, you know, 8 pounds, 5 pounds, give or take. But, you know, in the event of the house is burning down and, you know, I grab that one thing, it's the Drobo because it has everything on it. Now, I have about five or so places where all my media gets backed up. I have a time capsule for the laptop. And the Drobo, and also have the Time Machine volume that's built into the PowerMac G5 is just an extra hard drive in there. And I also utilize Mosey Online Backup. So in the case that I'm not even home and I lose everything, the whole house, all of my photos, all these movies are still backed up online. And the way Mosey works is it just runs in the mini bar. You set it, and you're like, okay, I want it to back up this, this, and this on the internal hard drive, and I want this, this, and this on, like, the external hard drive. Okay? Save that configuration and forget about it. That's it.
Wow.
It runs, you know, like, every day. You know, once you finish that initial backup, it just runs at the time interval that you specify.
Wow. So you are very well backed up, and I can see you've got an excellent strategy. I am not quite in that good a shape, and I. So that's what Allison and I have been talking about, is how we kind of bring it up to our standards up so that we are well covered. Mm-hmm. So I think we can learn from what you're doing there, Brent, but it probably won't happen in a day or two. We're going to have to work at it a little bit.
Yeah, I think the best thing that's worked out for me is dedicated Time Machine volumes for each computer. You know, I have the time capsule for the laptop, an internal hard drive for the G5, and I also have the Drobo, and I also have online. So I can easily, you know, revert to a file that was deleted in the event of disaster.
Excellent.
Okay.
So let me ask another question here about recording and content and disk space. I'm thinking of switching over here shortly to HD content, which is going to very much expand my file disk utilization.
Yes.
So, well, what are you using HD content yet, or recording it?
I am not. I record just TV shows and just home movies, and that's it. So I have not made the transition to HD, but at the rate that I'm going now, you know, I fill up a lot of content, which is standard def stuff. Just wait till we all transition to HD. It's going to be that much worse.
And you've got expandable answers so that when and if you go to HD content, you can quite easily just add more disk space?
Very easy. All I have to do is pull out the smallest hard drive and put in a larger one. That's it.
And pay the bucks.
Yeah, but it's the solution to the problem that I had of running out of disk space.
Yeah, and with the cost of disks coming down and down per gigabyte, per terabyte, it's becoming more and more practical to do that, I find.
Oh, right. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Well, this has been pretty instructive for me and hopefully for Allison's listeners. Are there any other last comments you want to make about your process and its flow, Brent?
I don't think so. I think we covered everything. And if they have any questions, they can just, you know, reach me on Twitter, and I'd be glad to solve, you know, some people's problems, because I love doing this stuff. And just to see my parents' faces, you know, when my little brother was learning how to ride a bike on the big screen TV in their living room, that's worth it. You know, the time that it takes to do this and to be able to say, you know, 30 years from now, I want to watch that video, and it's going to be the same quality that it was when I recorded it that day, then, you know, it's just worth it. So if you have any questions, I'd be glad to help out, you know, any of the listeners of the podcast and kind of instruct them and give them a little bit more detail than what I've been able to discuss here today.
Excellent. And go ahead and remind the listeners where they can find you on Twitter.
Okay. My handle is TruckLover, and that's TruckLover.
Excellent. Well, listen, Brent, I very much appreciate you spending some time with me today, and I think I've learned a few things that I might be able to apply to my next steps in the digital video capture processing. So thank you very much, and we'll certainly be in touch.
Oh, sounds good. Fantastic. Thank you for having me today.
I really enjoyed listening to that because it was so interesting to hear a completely different way to get at the same problem. Well, this week I was talking to a buddy of mine, and he was asking about my process for using Camtasia Studio on Windows to create video screencasts. I explained to him how powerful it is and how it does have a steep learning curve, but then when you get the hang of it, you can do amazing work. While I had him on the phone, I explained that there's another tool in my tool belt that I use for creating written documentation, not video. And of course, I had to tell him about ScreenSteps. He was intrigued right off the bat and asked for a screen share. I showed him how I could take instant or time screenshots, which are great for capturing those elusive pull-down menus, how I could annotate the images by drawing boxes around them, putting in arrows, adding text, even showing a sequence of steps in a menu. Then I showed him how I could put the text to go with the graphics, add hyperlinks, and then without straining a single mental muscle, hit export to PDF and get a fabulous document that anyone would be proud to send to a customer, coworker, boss, or even friend. I didn't even show him how you could send it up to WordPress or to Wiki, or I didn't even show him ScreenSteps Live, and I thought he was going to just break into tears. He said, "Wow, I need this. I love this. I can't believe I've lived without this. I have to get off the phone so I can go buy it." He really went nuts when I told him the low-end version of ScreenSteps is only $40, and then that the pro version lets you export full manuals, and it's only $60. If you'd like to get out from under the doom and horror of creating manuals in Microsoft Word, or even struggling to make single annotated screenshots, I highly recommend you head on over to screensteps.com and make sure you use my coupon code NOSILLA, that's all capital letters, my name spelled backwards, pretty tricky, huh? You'll get 25% off the purchase price if you use that coupon code. Well, this is going to be a really long show, guys. I just checked in with the chat room, and they said to keep going, longer the better, but we got a lot more show to go yet, and that's if I still cut out two bits and put them to next week. Well, on a show a while back, I mentioned how cool it is that AT&T gives free Wi-Fi access to iPhone users, but that my Starbucks is so efficient that they make my coffee faster than I can log into the AT&T network. When you walk in, you go to the web, and it comes up with a screen to enter your phone number. It's really, really teeny, not iPhone-friendly at all. If you succeed in clicking into that teeny tiny text field, you enter your phone number, hit done, and then you have to get your finger on an even smaller I agree to the T's and C's box. Once that's done, a text message, which is free, is sent to your iPhone. So you navigate over there, then you have to click on the link they sent you. This takes you back to the web browser to complete the confirmation. I've tried skipping that last step, and you don't get the confirm, so it doesn't work. Anyway, this process works fine, but I'm on my way out the door with a Grande Non-Fat No-Whip Extra Hot Mocha by the time the darn thing gets Wi-Fi ready for me. What I usually do is go to Preferences and turn off Wi-Fi and surf that way while I'm waiting in line because it's actually faster. How sad is that? Well, lucky for me, I have a worldwide audience for my complaining because I was inundated with recommendations for an application that would solve all my problems. Dave Southard was the first one to come up with the idea, so I'll read his email first. We met very briefly at Macworld at the Macworld Roundtable podcast. Don't expect you to remember me. And I must admit I'm more of a podcast consumer than contributor. This is me giving back. Please share it if you like. By the way, I don't have any affiliation with this company. You mentioned a problem with logging into your Starbucks Wi-Fi hotspot. There's a great application for doing this that I've been using since its inception. Basically, you configure it with your info, and when you walk into an AT&T hotspot, open it up, and it takes care of the login stuff, and then you close it. Your Wi-Fi will now work. It takes about 20 seconds, usually. It's from DeviceScape, and it's called Easy Wi-Fi for AT&T iPhones, and it's free. Thanks for the great show. Keep up the good work. Then Ryan Gray tweeted me about it, then Steve S. Trent 57 explained a little more. He said, check out the free application, Easy Wi-Fi for AT&T from DeviceScape Software. It's fast and works great. Simple to set up, enter your phone number the first time you run the app, then it's one touch to log into your Starbucks Wi-Fi. Might even beat the super efficient baristas. Since the podcast has been out for a few days, this is most likely old news, but just wanted to add my endorsement to this application. And then Ofer sent me an email about it, too. I felt like the last person on earth to hear about it. Well, let me say exactly how this works. First, you download the Easy Wi-Fi for AT&T application from iTunes. There is also a paid $3 app called Easy Wi-Fi that helps you get attached quickly to any Wi-Fi hotspot you frequent. But for the Starbucks example, we only need the free application. Launch the app, put in your phone number, and you're done. Well, now you have to walk over to Starbucks or trip over one on your way down the street is probably a little more accurate. Once you're in range of the Wi-Fi, launch Easy Wi-Fi for AT&T, and you'll see these little green antenna things going out while it says logging in. In about 2 seconds for me, the login button changes to log out. And that's it. You're on. What a great example of an application that does one thing and does it well. Thanks to everyone who contacted me about this through email and Twitter. What a fantastic tip. Here's another one where I was stuck and everyone came to my aid. On the Mac Roundtable, I think it was, I was whining about the fact that it's impossible to get to the search field in the contacts list on the iPhone. No matter how hard I try, I always end up triggering the plus sign for a new contact, even though I can see that there's this little magnifying glass there teasing me. Luckily, again, the listeners are smarter than me. Good thing I never pretended to be the smart one around here, or this would be really embarrassing. I actually got two different solutions. John from Perth, not to be confused with Jane from Perth, sent in an email that said, when in contacts, hold your finger on, say, the D letter on the right-hand side and slide your finger up to the top of the screen. You should then be able to use the search box. I tried it, and shazam, there was that lovely search box I'd been looking for. A little bit later, Nick Tamburi wrote in with the exact same tip. Joseph1996 and Duya on Twitter both suggested I tap the clock/time to get the search to come up. That worked great, too. I can't believe how happy this makes me, but it really does remove a major irritant in my life. You see, since my last name is Sheridan, and S is the most popular surname start letter in the whole United States, about a third of my contacts seem to be under S, so scrolling through it has been tedious, to say the least. Thanks to all who sent in suggestions for relieving me from this agony.
Webster's Dictionary defines satisfaction as confident acceptance of something as dependable, true, and enjoyable. The contentment one feels when one has fulfilled a desire, need, or expectation. Amen to that. I am satisfied. Satisfaction is seeing a customer get into their car after I replace their clutch and watching them drive away with a big smile. Satisfaction is getting into a car and turning the key and hearing it purr after rebuilding the engine. Ever since I was a boy growing up in Louisiana, I have been around machines. My father instilled a mechanical attitude in me about them. Cars are machines, and machines sometimes need maintenance. If that maintenance is performed properly, the machine will perform as it was intended. When it works like it's supposed to, that good feeling you get when operating it is satisfaction. I am Honda Bob, and I have been doing maintenance on Honda and Acura machines for over 30 years, and I still love the satisfaction I get when I finish working on a car. If you want the satisfaction of having your Honda or Acura perform perfectly, give me a call at 562-531-2321. To learn more about your car, log on to my website at www.hdabob.com. HDA Bob's mobile service is not affiliated with Honda, Acura, or Honda Worldwide.
It's time for another exciting episode of Chit Chat Across the Pond with Bart Bouchatz from BartB.ie. How is Ireland today, Bart?
Ireland is fine. I'm in a slightly nostalgic mood. I had to go clean out my desk from when I was doing my graduate studies.
Aww.
And I found lots of old things.
Aww.
Mostly from my students' union days. I was such a pompous git.
You said you found stickers from your campaign?
Yeah, I found stickers from when I ran for vice president of the students' union. And I also found my grand design for what was going to be the permanent all-time record of all motions ever passed at union council, at student union council. It had one motion in it, and the rest of the book was empty, and it's now about 6 years old. So I threw it in the bin. It was a great idea. It never took off.
Well, good. All right. Well, let's kick in. We got a lot on the table today. I actually wanted to bring up a security light thing. There was a, I don't remember, did we already talk about Pwn2Own on the show?
We mentioned Pwn2Own last week as one of the things that scared me because of how, you know, Safari and all the browsers were hacked. But then you dug up this interview with the German young fella who wants to remain mostly anonymous, so he's only going by his first name. And I presume you're going to stick the link in the show notes, because I think it's actually a really good interview worth reading, particularly if you still feel that, you know, Mac users worrying about security is just being silly. I think you need to read what this young chap says about how easy it is to hack the Mac.
Yeah, actually, so this one guy did Safari, Firefox, and IE8. He owned the machines on all three of them. And it turns out when he did Safari, he did it on the Mac. But when he did Firefox, he did it on the Mac. And he specifically said he did it. He could have done it on Windows, but he said it was so much easier to crack it on the Mac that that's why he did it there. So
yeah, Vista has leapfrogged OS X in terms of actual security, not security by obscurity through the fact that it's a platform that they know less about and they have less experience on. In terms, you know, if you have complete experience of all the operating systems, Windows is physically easier because Apple have messed up the implementation of some of the security features in Leopard. Now, thankfully, Snow Leopard is just around the corner, so, you know, in theory, hopefully they fix this. But, like, address space layout randomization, which is a mouthful to say, which is why most people call it ASL. Is that right? Address space layout. ASLR. There we go. I knew I was missing a letter there. In theory, both OS X and Windows have it. The problem is Windows did it right and OS X did it wrong.
So
it doesn't work.
Well, part of the one of the things I wanted to say about this interview with Niels is his final line was exactly what you've been saying, and that's kind of why I put it in the security light category, is you keep saying ever-present vigilance. The last line he said is, people need to know that bad things can happen while you surf the internet, regardless of what you use. Software vendors should also concentrate on making it harder to exploit flaws. Bugs are always going to be there, but they have to work on making it tougher for attackers. So he basically said ever-present vigilance, and that is the security light here is, don't think that because you're on a Mac, you're invulnerable, you can still get spyware or get Trojan horses and things. You can be owned, you can have your machine completely taken over. So
This wasn't the attack that he used to own that, to basically win himself a MacBook, wasn't a Trojan. It was a proper exploit.
Oh, okay. Okay.
You know, just because we haven't been seeing those in the wild very much yet doesn't mean they don't exist. He demonstrated it. It's real.
So it's becoming less interesting to say, at least we don't have viruses.
It is,
because we still don't have that, but it does. So, I mean, I guess it can't spread like wildfire.
No, because we have to visit a web page for these kind of attacks.
Right. So I suppose that's a little bit better, but still.
It's pretty scary to me anyway. It's getting closer and closer to the Windows experience. And that's because Windows is meeting us halfway. It's not that we're going to the really, really bad days of Windows 98. We're not heading there. Windows is getting more secure. The Mac is getting more attacked. And so the user experience is going to meet in the middle somewhere.
Now, I know one of the worst things going on in Windows land right now is this, antivirus 2009 pop-up that comes up, and people click it, and then they end up getting, they said something like 9 million people have it, or 9 million machines, they think, got it in a course of a couple of weeks. Is that the kind of thing that would happen on a Mac because of these vulnerabilities?
Sure, absolutely. In fact, that ties into a related news item, sort of. We talked before about Trojans on the Mac and how they were on, you know, some of the more dodgy parts of the internet, gambling and pornography and that kind of thing, where they were masquerading as poker games or masquerading as codecs to let you see this free video of a lady with very little on doing something very naughty. But now these things have changed. So now there's a new variant out, variant number F, which is a letter, I guess, not a number. But this one isn't going after the CD underbelly of the internet. What it's doing is posing as legitimate software. So it's posing as a genuinely existing media player program using the same file name and everything and pretending to be that, only, of course, it isn't that. So if you download something and you're not getting it from the source, you're not getting it from the actual vendor, there's no guarantee that what you're getting is what it says it is.
Okay.
Well, so we've mentioned many times that you should only download programs from trusted sources.
So
this is why. This is happening for real.
The path I follow, so just to give the practical example, you go to a website and it says you need the latest version of Flash. That's what it usually is, right? Click here. I never, ever, ever click here. No matter, can be on anybody's site. If I'm not on Adobe.com where I navigated to that myself, I'm not going to click download now. So I go over and I type in the URL Adobe.com and I do a search for Flash and I download it. Then I go back to the website and refresh the screen and see if it worked. If that doesn't work, I'm done. I'm out of there.
Yeah, and if someone says to you, you need to get, you know, I don't know, Lights Viewer. This is a name I just made up, and it's made by, you know, Bare Bottom Software. Sorry. I'm running low on imagination today.
I don't know. It's all in the gutter, at least, what you do have.
You don't just go to Google and type in the name and go to any old site. You look for the actual developer's website, and you make sure you get it from the actual developer and not from some random place. Even if some nice person on their blog is offering a direct download, don't do it.
Right.
Always get it from the horse's mouth.
I think that does make really comes home to our security light is here's the problem and here's what you do about it. So you can still play and have fun on the internet. Just, you know, follow these kind of obvious rules and it's a lot easier. But you're starting to say there's a cross-platform flaw?
There's a cross-platform Firefox flaw. Now, this annoys me somewhat because the guys who discovered this, rather than going to Mozilla quietly and saying, here's a vulnerability, here's your exploit, they just published the exploit code on the web.
Oh, that's poor.
Here is the code that exploits the flow in Firefox. Say, oh, come on. I'm a big fan of responsible disclosure, and I get very grumpy when people don't. So the flaw is out there, and it's been out there, I think, since Wednesday. Mozilla are frantically scrambling to write a patch, and they promise to have one early next week, so probably Monday or Tuesday. So when your Firefox asks to update itself, let it. This is a cross-platform flaw that allows what's called drive-by installing. So you visit a website, and behind your back, it has downloaded a program to your computer and installed it.
Nice, nice.
Yeah, not good.
Oh, dear.
And this is Windows, Linux, Mac, so cross-platform.
Wow. Now, do I get to count this as a Firefox update when we have our argument about how many Firefox updates?
Oh, yes. This will be, what are we, 3.0.8.
Okay, good. I just want to make sure.
One little thing, just because I like to get this little dig in from time to time. According to some Apple websites, you are protected if you use NoScript.
Okay. Yeah, I'd be protected, but I would still push. Okay, let it do it.
Yeah, let it do it.
I don't know what it means. All right, well, that was an 8.5 minute security light, so we better move on.
Yes, we better, because it's good stuff.
Last week, or I think it was 2 weeks ago, I accidentally did not record Bart's voice.
This is very funny. It's very important we say what show this was. It was the show we were talking about backup.
Right. So after all of our discussion about backup, I looked at my recording and I only had recorded me. But, you know, I mean, I'm a narcissist, so that's good. That worked out. But but we thought it'd be more interesting if you heard both of us. And luckily, Bart had done a backup recording using Call Recorder on his end. So that's great news, except it makes a ginormous file because it's an uncompressed audio file and we don't want to do compression twice. So you needed to send it to me and I said, well, I'll just throw it in my Dropbox. But later I found you'd found a different path.
Yeah, I didn't throw it in Dropbox because for reasons I'll explain in a moment, I do not do Dropbox file sharing with other people. I love Dropbox to bits. It's one of my absolute favorite programs. But no, I'm not using it for sharing with other people. So instead, I decided this was the perfect opportunity to test out a new feature in MobileMe. Now, this new feature should have been there ages ago because they promised it, you know, when they launched MobileMe and then didn't deliver it until they got MobileMe fixed, which probably isn't a bad thing. But MobileMe now has support for something called large file sharing. So you put a file into your iDisk and then you can right click on it in the MobileMe web interface and say share. And then it brings up a little dialogue where you can put in a password if you like and an email address, and it sends a special link to that file to the recipient, and they either do or don't have to type in the password. And the nice thing is that then in your interface, the MobileMe web interface, a little icon comes up next to the file that looks like sort of broadcasting radio waves, so that you can see that this is a file that you've shared out with someone, and you can click and get the details, and then you can unshare the file. And did it work?
It worked perfectly.
Yeah, it worked perfectly my end, and it worked perfectly your end, so I think we can chalk this one up as a success for MobileMe.
No, I'm not comfortable with that. We're actually saying we liked something in MobileMe.
It has gotten a lot stabler.
Yeah.
The web interface of the calendar is still, well, rubbish, quite frankly.
Okay, good.
But that's just the web interface that's rubbish. The actual syncing has been fantastic since their last update. It is working through my work proxies. It is working quickly. It's not quite instant, but it's, you know, 2 minutes, which is close enough to instant. The service is working. Now, if they could get around to making the calendar interface on the web not be terrible, that would be great. But it's actually, you know, they're actually starting to live up to their promise in a lot of things. So I'm actually becoming a fan of MobileMe again, slowly. And the fact that this file sharing worked so well, it was really well thought out, really well implemented, really easy to do, and it just worked. That's the way it's meant to be on the Mac. It's all meant to just work, but this just worked.
Now I'm trying to remember. I think I got an email that said you'd shared it with me. Is that right?
That's how it works. You get an email with a link, and then you can download it. And then I think it shares by default for a month, and then it becomes unshared.
Okay.
Or I can unshare it whenever I want.
Now, when I download it, does it disappear on your iDisk, or does it stay there?
No. You don't get control over it. You just get to download it.
Okay. All right. But, I mean, it's like in Dropbox. If I take it out of your Dropbox, it disappears on your Dropbox. So that's why I was asking that question, which is a pretty unintuitive part of Dropbox. It doesn't necessarily make sense instantly to a lot of people.
Yeah, this is one of the reasons I don't like Dropbox. I guess there's sort of three reasons I don't like Dropbox when it comes to sharing folders with people. My disk space is precious, and I don't particularly want other people having the power to take space of mine by throwing stuff into a folder on their machine and having it suddenly gobble up space on my three machines. I don't like that.
I have definitely noticed that. As all of a sudden I'm going, wait a minute, I'm missing like 2 gigabytes. Where did that go?
It's like, oh, okay, yeah, you know, someone has just thrown in a giant big, Lord knows what, raw, unedited podcast or something.
Right, exactly.
As certain producers of certain international type podcasts are known to do. Say, oh, we edit, you know, we can edit collaboratively this way. It's like, yes, but it's a giant big file that's just been pushed at my machine.
Right.
In fairness to Sue, he hasn't done it with me. He's done it with other people to edit files together. But, I mean, you know, it's just insane to be able to take my disk space without my permission, basically.
Okay.
The other thing, then, is, I now have decent broadband, but it's not great. And it works fine for Skype recording unless there's someone using it for something else at the same time. Mm. So if I have a shared folder with someone, at any time of the day or night, they can drop something into it, and whoop, there goes my bandwidth.
Oh, I didn't even think about that.
And I have no control over it. So I can't, you know, because we have a thing in the house. When I'm podcasting, it's been prearranged and everyone knows that they are not to download while I'm podcasting. But I can't tell everyone I share a folder with. Now, you know, at this time, GMT, there's to be no file transfers into that shared folder. It's not practical. And then the last one, of course, is the fact that I don't want people to be able to reach into my hard drive and delete stuff. I'm sorry, no.
Yeah, that was the weirdest thing to me when I gave something. I think the first time I used it was to Tim Verporten of the Mac Review Cast, and I like to keep all the reviews I've made, and I did a review, and then he took it, and I was like, wait a minute, it's gone.
You need to copy it in there, basically, rather than putting it in there.
Which means everything I put in my Dropbox is in there. I'm taking up twice as much disk space now.
And if you're using Dropbox across multiple machines, that's even more.
Oh, yeah, that's right. That's right. Everywhere where it is, it exists again.
Yeah, and it just drives me nuts. So I don't file share with people. And apologies, I know some people have gone grumpy with me for it, but no, sorry, not happening.
But now, what do you... You said you still use it a lot. What do you use it for?
I use it for my stuff. It's wonderful for keeping everything in sync. Mm-hmm. All of my important files are in there. They're still backed up on my Time Machine in all three locations. I can get at them from anywhere. I mean, it's really handy. I had to, at short notice, apply for promotion in work because I hadn't noticed that there was a notice out looking for applications. So I needed a copy of my CV. It wasn't at home, it was in my Dropbox. So I edited it, saved it, submitted my application.
What's a CV?
Curriculum vitae, resume, I think you guys call them.
And what's the word again you use?
CV, short for curriculum vitae. It's one of these fancy Latin words we use over here in Europe.
Oh, you guys are so cool.
I was going to say so antiquated, but...
Well, actually, we use a French word, so why not, right?
Oh, resume is French, isn't it?
Yeah. It must be. It's got that little accent, the goo on it, so...
If people bother writing it in.
Right. Okay, so you keep your own stuff in sync so that because you use multiple Macs, you can get to it from anywhere. That's cool.
Yeah, so for me, it's a replacement of what iDisk should do, but what iDisk does badly. So I use iDisk for sharing files, which is what most people use Dropbox for, and I use Dropbox for being a pretend iDisk. It's strange, but it works well.
Those are some really good points. I guess if you have infinite bandwidth and gigantic disk space, that would take care of 2/3 of the problem, but you would still have the problem that you have to copy things so people can't delete stuff off your hard drive.
Yeah, I don't like that. I'm sorry, you don't get access to my hard drive. It's a one-way thing.
Well, thank goodness that $100 a year is worth something to you now, right?
That's true, actually. I keep on forgetting quite how much it is. But having got so many months for free, it doesn't bother me. I think my renewal isn't until like Christmas or something.
Right, right. All right, well, let's move on. You have a new gadget to play with, huh?
Yes, I do. Yes. It's called a Spider 2 Express. So it's a tool for calibrating your monitor. It's Windows and Mac, but not Linux. And it's basically a combination hardware-software thing. So you get this sensor, which sort of looks like a spider because, well, I sent you a photo to put in the show notes. So that'll
it's a
show
tripod,
you what it looks like.
Tripod spider. It's only a three-legged
spider. It's a tripod spider, but it does look like it's hanging on a web.
That's true.
Basically, this thing is a sensor. I'm not exactly sure what to call it, but it's a yoke for measuring the light. So it's either some sort of spectrometer or photometer or both. But it reads the color and the intensity of light. So you put it on your monitor. It tells you, basically, the software comes with a wizard and it steps you through step by step. What kind of monitor is this? Is this an LCD? Is it a projector? Is it a CRT? Is it a laptop? You just choose what it is, you on to the next step. And it talks you through it step by step. And then it draws a picture of the spider on the screen and says, put it here. And then click continue. And then it puts a large box over where the spider is, and it starts to cycle through colors. Oh. So first it does all the greens, and it starts off at very, very dark green, and then a lighter green, and then a lighter green, and a lighter green. It steps through all the greens, then it steps through all the reds.
So the software's changing the color on the screen?
Yeah, and then the device is reading what's actually being put out by the screen.
Oh, okay.
Then it steps through all the grays, and then the last thing it does is does a white point verification, so it puts up what it thinks should be pure white without any other colors to verify that it's picked up all the settings correctly, and it keeps tweaking itself. And then when you're done, it creates a color profile for how your monitor actually renders color, because it has measured the output as you go. And then you use that profile for your monitor instead of the default profile that you would use with OS X. And the end result is that white on your screen is completely white. There is no color cast on your screen.
Okay, so you remember that part about what problem were you trying to solve?
Well, okay, for me, the problem is that I'm a teeny tiny bit of a perfectionist when it comes
really?
To photography.
Really?
Yeah, really. Who'd have guessed?
I have not noticed that.
And I actually will tweak the white balance in my photographs to what I think is perfection. Of course, they're now all too blue because actually my monitor was completely uncalibrated. And my monitor was very much towards the red end. So everything was too warm. So to compensate for that warmness, I was dialing in more blue. Uh-huh. Which, of course, meant that for everyone else on the planet was seeing my photographs more blue than they were meant to be. And the other thing, the reason I really knew I had a problem is I have two screens here. I have the screen on my Mac Mini and I have the screen on my laptop. And when you would look at one and then spin your head over to the other, you would know that the white wasn't white. It's like, oh my God, that's so blue. And then you turn back and go, oh my God, that's so red. Now they're exactly the same because they're both actually white.
Okay. So do they look the same now?
They don't look identical because the monitors still have different physical brightnesses. So you still, your eyes still have to adapt slightly as you go from monitor to monitor, but the color is spot on the same. It's identical.
Huh.
The other thing it does is that it really makes your blacks inky black because they're perfectly calibrated and your whites are as white as your monitor can make them. Now, depending on your monitor, that'll be more or less white. But they, you know, the range is perfectly spread out to really make use of everything the monitor has to offer.
So I'm still back to what difference does it make whether your monitor looks right? If my monitor's messed up, it's not going to matter that your monitor was messed up.
It means you're still not going to be able to put stuff on the web and have everyone see it perfectly. But if you're bang on right, then you're at least halfway closer. If you're off to the left and other people are off to the right, then they're going to see something way off. But if you're bang on in the middle, as in you're perfectly calibrated, then everyone is only seeing it a little bit different to what you see it. Because they're either a little too warm or a little too cold.
Okay, I guess
so,
I can
do
that.
It means everyone's close. Whereas before, if you were off to one side or the other, then you had a whole bunch of people who were spot on and way, way, way more people who were completely off.
Hmm.
Also, if you print anything, you really want to calibrate your monitor. Because the color I see on screen will now be the color that comes out of the printer.
See, that's what I teased you about at first, but you don't print hardly anything, right?
Apart from calendars and things.
That's true.
And I did actually notice on the calendars that they all came out a little bluer than I thought, but I just put it down to the fact that, you know, Apple's printing process must have messed that up. The arrogance. But no, it was my color profile was off. It was too warm, so I was overcompensating with blue.
So if you had a Dell monitor, you could calibrate with it. You could calibrate it too. It didn't have to be an Apple monitor.
No, I did it on my MacBook Pro. I did it on my Samsung something or other. It says it has a Magic Tune and a Magic Bright. So obviously, oh, SyncMaster. There it is. That's the model number. SyncMaster 910N. I did it on my Apple Cinema display in work.
Huh. Okay. The reason
and it
I'm
worked
asking
fine.
Is,
so I did it on G4, a G5, and an Intel. Worked fine.
To me, it would be helpful if you had two monitors and they weren't looking quite the same. Like, Steve has a 17-inch Apple Cinema display that's, God, that thing's like 7 or 8 years old, and the screen is just gorgeous. I mean, it looks fantastic. And then he's got a brand new, or, you know, 6-month-old, maybe it's a year by now, Dell 24-inch display, and the Dell doesn't look anything like the Apple display. It's just not near as beautiful as the Apple display, and it's brand new. I mean, it looks good, but if you see it next to it, it's kind of irritating to go between the two. I'm wondering if it would get it closer at least?
Yeah, it should get them closer, because at least the white point will be the same.
Okay.
So the color temperature would be the same. Now, you'd have to do a bit of jiggery-pokery, because this thing does it for your primary display, but it saves it off as a .ics file, so you can actually copy that file. So you'd have to do one, then drag your menu bar to the other one, do it, and keep the two ICS files. But you could do it. There's instructions.
ICS files.
I found instructions on that.
I thought ICS files were calendar files.
I think, is it ICS? It's I something.
Okay.
They're color sync files, and the Windows has them as well. And printers, if you're getting something printed professionally, they'll want your color sync file.
Okay. So, but you could have them both calibrated that way? You'd tell it to...
It'd take a little bit of work, but you can do them both, yes.
Okay. Okay, so how much does this thing cost?
Okay, I picked it up on Amazon Lakota.UK, and including shipping to Ireland, it came to €91.
Okay. I just looked it up on the website on datacolor.com, and it was $79 US straight from them. So, but once you use it, you're done? You just throw it in a drawer and...
No, your monitor won't stay calibrated. The reason it doesn't look perfect anymore, because I'm sure it was calibrated when I left Apple's workshop, they slowly move out of sync. So once a month, it'll pop up a reminder and say, it's about time you calibrate it again. It's about a 5-minute process, maybe 10. It's really not stressful at all, because you click next a few times, put the spider on it, and then walk away and let it do its thing.
Looks like it'd be kind of fun to watch. Make you feel
actually, yeah,
productive.
You do actually. You see it cycling through the colors, and it actually tells you what it's doing.
Yeah.
Which is kind of nice. And you can also see it adjust, because it adjusts the color sync profile while it's your live profile, so you can actually see it change as it goes.
Interesting. I'm not the perfectionist that you are, but I can see that this makes you really happy.
Yeah, honestly, it is like a new lease of life, especially the sync, the Samsung. It was not a pretty-looking monitor. I didn't actually realize it could look as good as it looks now.
Interesting. So
I was all ready to spend money I don't really have on a cinema display. And I'm not going to bother now. So it saved me quite a bit of money.
Oh, that's good. Hey, I'm going to switch gears on us here. And okay. I have one more thing that's not on the agenda, but I'm doing it this way because I want to completely embarrass you. So Nick Brennan wrote in with a dumb question. And let me read it and tell you what I wrote back to him, and then we'll talk about what we discovered later this week. He said, here's a dumb question. Why does Bart only have 1 gigabyte of RAM in his MacBook Pro? Surely a man with his knowledge would want to max that baby out. I think if any of the listeners have a spare 2 gigabyte module lying around, they should send it to him so that he can enjoy happy computing with the rest of us sporting 2 gigabytes or more. Well, I wrote back and I said, well, when he bought the MacBook Pro, that was, a gigabyte was a fair amount of RAM. It's around 3 years old now.
Yeah.
And I said, he can't swing the cost of a new one for a while. I don't think 2 gigabyte modules are lying around yet, are they? Nice of you to think of him, though. So he wrote back and he said, well, I found one for $17 at Newegg and said, maybe we should get the listeners to throw in some money to help him spring for the $17. So now let's fast forward to yesterday when Bart and I were chatting away and I mentioned this conversation and he said, well, it isn't the cost because that isn't much money, but it's because I can't do it without invalidating the factory warranty and I'm still under Apple Care.
Yes, and I will not do anything to void my warranty. However, this is the point where Bart looks completely silly because in my head I have swapped two things. It is next to impossible to change the hard drive on one of these things.
Unless
you have your own Pat Dangler on standby to do it for you, which I don't. However, it's not difficult to change the RAM. They're just under the battery. But for some reason, in my head, I had equated the two. And so I hadn't even been considering buying RAM because, you know, I'm not doing that. Oh, goodness, I'm not taking this thing apart. So I'm stuck with the 80 gig hard drive.
Right.
but there's no earthly reason for me to stay with 1 gig of RAM. So we had a look around them. I actually have a Core Duo, not a Core 2 Duo, so this is literally the very first incarnation of the MacBook Pro. So it's, you know, it can only take a maximum of 2 gigs into 1 gig chips.
Six, right.
So I looked around on OWC because they really break it down so well. Like, any dummy can buy RAM on OWC. Yeah, what kind of Mac do you have? I have one of these. Here are all the types of RAM you can have. It's like, okay, I'll take that one. But it was, it was $26 for the two sticks. So I'm going to do that. And I'm probably going to enjoy it quite a lot. I mean, I cannot have takeout for 2 days, and that's paid for it. You know? Now, I don't have takeout every day. Obviously, I have takeout about once or twice a month. But I'll just forgo takeout for 2 months, and then I'll have paid for this, and I'm going to get so much enjoyment out of it. So thank you very much to the listener for
Nick,
for reminding me how stupid I've been.
I don't think I've enjoyed a chat with you as much as I enjoyed that yesterday when the light bulb went on, and I'm saying, no, I'm pretty sure you just opened the battery up on that.
Yeah, so thank you for that, for appearing with me.
Thank you for letting me publicly humiliate you on that. It's just so rare that I'm wrong, I'm right and you're wrong, that I just had to make sure everybody knew about that.
Also, when it comes to things like this, I'm quite happy to be wrong.
Because exactly.
2 gigs of RAM is twice as good as one.
Actually, that's a good point. A lot of times when I call or I'll write to a vendor and tell them something isn't working right in their software, and they tell me that I'm just an idiot, that's the best news, right? Because if you find out you're doing it wrong, that's great. That's way easier than changing software code.
That's true. You don't have to replace your whatever. Just use it right. Oh, okay.
Stop being a moron. I like it. All right, Bart. Well, I'm probably done torturing on that, but I do thank Nick for giving us so much enjoyment on that.
Yeah, and it's also, you know, for anyone else who's worrying about these things, OWC, stick in your make and model, wazam, up they come.
Oh, yeah.
It'll even recommend the best option.
And if you don't know how to install things, like on a hard drive, they'll give you the instructions on how to do it for that, and they also have lifetime guarantee.
Sweet. No, I'm not changing the hard drive.
No.
When the AppleCare runs out in June, I might consider it, but until then, I'm not.
Yeah, well, I'll give you Pat's email address. She can walk you through it there. I mean, it's possible.
If I buy a plane ticket, for that money, I could buy a new MacBook Pro.
It's not that it's impossible. It's just probably 238 screws by the time you're done. I mean, it's really...
Oh, taking them out is easy. The bit I'm worried about is making it all go back into one.
That's true. And I just hate the cracking the case part. You know, you have to pop things, and you just know it's never going to go back right unless Pat does it.
Yeah, I am so glad that 4 years ago, when it was a ridiculous and insane amount of memory, that I put a gig into my Mac Mini. Because it's a G4, and a gig was ridiculous money. I think I paid like €400 for the RAM and €500 for the Mac Mini, and everyone thought I was insane. But that's done me sterling service, and it saved me having to get out the putty knife and crack into that.
You talk about the RAM being a lot. I was on Steve's machine the other day, and he had some really weird viewer application. I was like, what is that? And so I opened it up, and it turned out it was a viewer for looking at a magazine on your monitor. It was really very cool, and the magazine was Mac World Magazine from a long time ago, whenever the first iMacs that were all in one piece came out. Not the lampshade one, but the one right after that.
The Bondi Blue, or... Mean the first flat panel ones?
The flat panel one after the lampshade one. The lamp one.
So they would have been the ones with the big chin.
I'm not sure what the chin is, but the white ones.
Chin.
Right, right.
They were famous. You know the bit under the screen that's now become very small?
Right.
Where the Apple logo is. They used to be very big compared to the 17 inches of screen.
Oh, yeah.
So they looked like a giant big chin, which is why they're called the big chin iMacs.
Never heard it called that. Well, anyway, so it's this really old version of the magazine. It was really fun to flip through. And they were talking about how this model comes with 256 megabytes of RAM. But you really should upgrade that to 512.
That's actually a lot, because I remember my first machine came with 4, and I doubled it to 8. And that was so big. But it had 16 megahertz. Not gigahertz, megahertz.
Now, the problem with having this discussion is I can always win, since my mother is still using her PC that is 26 years old and has 8 megabytes of hard disk.
You see, the scary thing is that the iPhone has infinitely more CPU, 700 odd megahertz. My first machine was 16. You know, it has something like 128 megs of RAM. Wow. My first machine had 4.
Wow.
And my first machine had 40 megabyte hard drive, and the iPhone has 16 gigs.
That's crazy. That is crazy.
I'm pretty sure the iPhone on screen renders more than 16 colors and is more than 640 by 480. Oh, maybe the screen is the same. 640 by 480?
I'm not
sure. The iPhone might be about that. So maybe the screen is still the same number of pixels approximately, only in an area, you know, way smaller, so it looks much better.
Wow. Well, after this lovely trip down memory lane, I think
this
that's
is probably time for the happy computing bit, isn't it?
Let's see. Yeah, we got to get that in here soon. Oh, I just checked it. It's 480 by 320.
Oh, so it's a little less.
A little less. 640
by 480. Okay, so that's one thing my old machine still has over my iPhone. It has a bigger screen. It's not much of a claim to fame when a desktop has a bigger screen than a phone.
Really, really. All right. Well, now let's call it a game.
Okie dokie. I'm pretty sure I'm on for business as normal next week, but the week after I'm going to be away. Or is it the week after the week after? I'm away sometime. I'm going on holidays.
Okay.
But anyway, next week I'm definitely still around. So until then, happy computing.
So while we were in the live show, Bart snuck a note over to me in the chat to say that he had a quick question or a quick correction. Turns out the Firefox update came out yesterday. So go ahead and run that Firefox update and get yourself safe. I also found out from the live chat room that Bart was on episode 25 of Mac 20 Questions. So if you want to hear a little bit more from Bart, head on over there and hear that great show. And while I was there, I noticed that Ben Frixel was on it as well. He was on show number 26, and he's a good friend of the show. So head on over to Mac 20 Questions, and actually it's mac20q.com, and I put direct links in the show notes. Well, that's going to wind up the longest NoSilicast podcast of all time. We're at an hour and 20 minutes while I'm watching here. You can blame the chat room because they keep going more, more, more. So it's their fault. If you'd like to send in a dumb question, a comment, praise, heck, you can even complain if you want to, send it in to allison@podfeet.com. Be sure to Twitter me over at twitter.com/podfeet. And I guess that's going to wind up the show for this week. Thanks for listening and stay subscribed.